Hello and welcome to Next 2.0 on WQLN NPR. Next is produced by the Public Voice Media. I'm your host, Marcus Atkinson, with guest host, Chuck Camerata. If you want to know more about Next 2.0, you can go to Facebook and like the page. You can also follow us on Instagram at Next 2.0 Erie to keep up with the upcoming show promos, events, and clips about what's next for our communities and our democracy. Thank you so much for tuning in. Christian nationalism. That's all I'm going to say because our co-host Chuck Camerata developed the show today, so I'm going to pass it over to Chuck, and I will get in the passenger seat, and let's see what develops in this show today. Chuck.
Okay, so hold on in the passenger seat. So the question is behind today's program is, should America be a nation that declares itself Christian officially? Most Americans, 60-plus percent, say yes. But when you push those folks about that answer, they tend to not really know what they mean by that or what the implications of it are. So today on Next 2.0, we're going to talk about the burgeoning Christian nationalist movement and why it is, in my opinion at least, neither Christian nor American. And Marcus and I are here today with Chuck Nelson, who has been, how long have you been at the Cross?
12 years now.
So has been pastoring a little church called The Cross here in Erie, which is merging with St. Paul's. He's also a member of Erie City Council, was president of the council last year, so connected and involved. We're also here with Drew Himes, who's pastor of Church of the Cross, an adjunct professor at Gannon, a psychotherapist, an EMS instructor at Butler Community College, and I don't want to talk any more about his credentials because it makes me feel small. So I want to start by asking up front, it seems to me that getting a grip on and then talking about Christian nationalism isn't quite as easy as it might seem. So I want to ask you guys, what do you think of when you hear the word or the term Christian nationalists? What are we talking about in your mind when we're talking about Christian nationalism?
I think this has really developed to be a more clearly defined issue in the last couple years. Mm-hmm. I mean, really since 2016, 2015 time range. And what we're really seeing is, and probably even going further back, I would say even to 2008 when there was a white evangelical outrage over Obama. Mm-hmm. So you sort of see these different pinnacle spots politically and how that caused a certain reactionary tone from particularly a white evangelical background to move towards that preservation of making America great again. So, but I think as the vision for it has developed further and particularly as it's been adopted by Trump, I think we can see a further divorce of what the historic values of patriotism are and what the historic values of Christianity are to really create an identity that is unique to any other historic position.
Hmm. So I'm going to come back to talking about patriotism in a minute, but how do you think about Christian nationalism, Drew?
I get the nationalism part because we're talking about the USA, so I can say, okay, gotcha. The Christian part, I always stumble with to go, what Christianity or whose Christianity? Because at last count I saw, there's something like, and this is mostly Protestants, 1,400 different denominations. And so who's to say whose version of this we're talking about? Is it that the Roman Catholic way, that's the way we need to go, or... is it the Protestant? Is it Baptist? Where do we go with that? And so how do we define it? And then, as you said in your intro, it's not Christian to me as I look at it, as I read scripture, as I study it and do these things, I'm like, this doesn't really add up for me. Yeah. I don't see it. And when I think it back, because some of the arguments made are that, as you said before, America is founded to be a Christian nation, even though almost every founding father says, no, it wasn't.
Yeah, we'll come back to that.
Yeah, too, they were very clear on this point to say, no. And in fact, one, I'm trying to remember who was a Baptist minister from South Carolina. He was very clear to say that if the presidency changes or the Congress changes, the version of Christianity changes. And that could be a problem. I mean, you can move the country through all sorts of movements like that. Yeah. So I have a hard time saying, nationalism, gotcha. I know you're talking about this country. But Christianity, I have a huge question mark over that.
Yeah, that's a good point. So kind of broadly speaking, tell me if you think this is somewhat accurate, Marcus. I think kind of broadly speaking, Christian nationalism contends that America has been and should continue to be distinctively Christian.
I mean, how loudly can I yell BS on the air? This is a fascinating topic for me because, you know, having a new background in ministry compared to, you know, my guests and certainly compared to you, Chuck.
That's because I'm old. Thank you for that.
Well, I'm saying, I've said on my show before, I was raised Jehovah's Witness.
Yeah.
So all of these conversations about religion and denominations, I'm very new to a lot of these discussions. I learned a lot, I would say, in the last 5 years about discussions like this because I come from a background of being a part of a religion that says they're all serving Satan except for us. And so there was never any need to inspect, learn about. But obviously there was a desire to be more involved with civic engagement and how the inner workings of politics worked and then being introduced to the religious side of it. This is fascinating stuff. Obviously, the genesis of America does not scream Christianity to me. It's always been fascinating to me how we can have selective memory when it comes to these things. King said, when he was quoting the founding fathers, "We hold these truths to be self-evident that all men are created equal." You know where I'm going with that.
Yeah.
That was obviously except for you Negroes over there.
Yeah. Mm.
And so as silly as that sounds, as facetious as that sounds, that was the extent of it.
Absolutely.
You know? And so I'm as fascinated as the listener to hear how this show unfolds because there's just a lot I don't know.
Yeah.
And I've learned a lot, especially through my relationship with you, Chuck.
Yeah. Well, I'm learning as we go, too.
When you think about the Christian foundations, the argument will be made that the founding fathers wanted this. They wanted a Christian nation. If that were so, then their foundational documents, the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, would clearly articulate something that is cogently Christian.
Right.
Even if it was an earlier version, something, there would be clear declarations about the triunity of God, things that were held at that time, the salvation of God through Jesus Christ, something along those lines. We find none of that. In fact, in the Declaration, we find a description of nature's laws and nature's God, which is an incredibly deistic statement. Mm-hmm. This is the height of the Enlightenment. They're trying to stay away from individualized religion because they're breaking away from a kingdom that was run by a king and the chief bishop of the king who said this is the way stuff's going to be and they didn't want any part of this.
Yeah.
And if a lot of people will look at it and say, well, but they were all Christians when they came here. Okay, I don't think that's true at all. There were definitely Jewish communities. There were Muslim communities. They might not have been humongous, but a lot of the founding fathers make reference to these things. Yeah. And maybe don't take my word for it, but I brought a note here today that Washington, in a treaty with the government of Tripoli, clearly states the government of the United States is not in any sense founded on the Christian religion. So if there's anybody who knew what was going on in that time, I think George had a thought. And so it's hard to say that this was foundational.
Yeah.
In fact, it was actually much more clearly articulated that the idea was to have freedom of religion, not freedom for one specific religion.
Right.
And I think I would even argue to say there was also a belief of freedom from religion for those who chose that path.
If I'm not mistaken, Thomas Jefferson was notorious for having a Bible that was kind of a Frankenstein version of the Bible.
Oh, yes.
A lot of certain passages cut out, certain passages that he would highlight because there was that trepidation or that doubt or suspicion that you're describing for religion per se, especially from what they come out of. I thought that was interesting.
I think that one of the things that goes on at the time of the development of the American experiment is all of these folks have Christianity kind of in their blood. It's foundational to the cultures that people came out of when they came here. So it's partly the air that they breathe. Even though there were people of other faiths, even though there were many people among the founding fathers who were agnostic, Ben Franklin probably was considered a skeptic. There are people kind of all over the spectrum in terms of belief, but one of the things that they wrestled through early on was, do we want to declare a particular religion? Do we want to be a Christian nation? And when they sat down, and so individual colonies kind of dealt with that differently, but when they sat down to come together and build a nation, they said very specifically, no, we're not going to favor one religion over another. So in the word Christianity doesn't appear in any of the founding documents. Mm-hmm. And two of the clauses that I think are important are, no religious test shall ever be required as a qualification for any office or public trust in the United States. And the other one is, Congress shall make no law. And this is pretty well known, but I don't think we understand it correctly. Congress shall make no law respecting the establishment of a religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. Mm-hmm. So they're saying we want to give people permission to have their own particular faith. The government's not going to look over their shoulders about that. And to declare ourselves a Christian nation, especially today, given the diversity in our country, and I know people don't like the idea of diversity, but given the diversity in our country, we're talking about massive upheaval if we were to do anything like that. But I don't believe, even though Christianity was part of the discussion early on, I don't believe that the Founding Fathers intended for us to be a Christian nation. So for now, unless...
I mean, you're talking about like the Great American Experiment. Yeah. We're talking, you know, I think that the Massachusetts Bay Colony, the founding of that's a little different than what we're talking about. What ends mm-hmm. up happening is you get Roger Williams going mm-hmm. down to Rhode Island for that religious freedom. You get Quakers going to mm-hmm. Pennsylvania. You get William Penn. You have all these different things. And then when they come melted together, you end up with a different culture out of that.
Right.
One that was much more inclusive. And I think we actually see a similar thing that brings us to today's Christian nationalism in the way that the Big Sort occurs, you know, after World War II, where you start getting homogenous neighborhoods. And so, like, I'm sitting here with Drew, and he's Presbyterian, so that means he's probably Scottish, and that I'm Congregationalist. And you really are?
Absolutely. He is. Yeah, we were see, talking about it earlier.
How do you know?
I'm super Scottish.
And then, well, that's and then as a Congregationalist, you know which ethnicity I must be coming from, right?
More Eastern European?
Welsh.
English.
Welsh.
Yeah, that's it. But now I'm not, because that's just not how that works anymore for me.
Right. I just haven't
noticed the
Scottish
kilt when you walk. So we have this thing where in the 50s when you get, you know, because of the product of redlining, because of the, you know, suburbanization, because of these communities that become homogeneously white, and then at the same time that they all get this Scofield Bible in World War II, and that the world was coming to an end. With this very particular like minority theology that was never a majoritative position in the church. So you all of a sudden get, instead of that identifier of him being Presbyterian, me being Congregationalist, him being Scottish, you know, Lutherans, Germans, and all of these things, right. You get this new image of whiteness, and the categories stop being about what ethnicity you're coming in with and that diversity of it. And then you start getting labels like, and that I put on myself as an evangelical. Mm-hmm. Now the identifier no longer goes back to like an ethnicity or racial change. It goes back to this doctrinal position, which I think pivots things. And then layering that with some of the theology that was popular as World War II ends, and in this picture that the world is something that we need to oppose, and this resistance to progress. I think you have something that develops over the course of a couple decades with a few other coals thrown into the burner to escalate the heat. So even when I'm talking about earlier 2008 and 2016, those are just more pieces adding to the heat. But I think we've gotten to a boiling point on this, mm-hmm. where it's a very particular identity that that we can trace back, you know, beyond just 1776 stuff, because that was more of like a manifest destiny type of how the world ends type of thing. Progress was to be desired. And now we have this thing that is anti-progress, expecting the world to come to this end, and that we're a resistance against that to preserve this 50s mentality.
And what you brought up there, Chuck, is really good, because it crosses over with some of the early issues of the forming of this American experiment. And that's a really good word, because that's what it was always intended to be, is we're still working on progress. But there was a largely racial or ethnic component that comes into this. And you see how... I don't know, I say churches followed, or maybe they led. I'm not sure. I'd have to, you know, pick that apart. But in like post-World War II, the suburbs, which had never existed before, come into existence, and churches go right out there, and they become very homogenized, not, like you said beautifully, not around like I think about when I was in grad school, I went to, it was in Pittsburgh. The neighborhoods were very defined by German, Polish, Irish, et cetera. Not so much anymore, but still to a degree. A lot of that fell apart, and it was more around what's the local church. And people went that direction. And then thought progress went with that as well. And it wasn't so much about this is who we are, this is where we come from. This is our church. And it was defined by the neighborhood. And so what then happened is those churches in the suburbs were very white, because whites were running to the suburbs out of the cities because of Great Migration, which was still happening at that time. And there was, it wasn't, oh, hey, this is great progress. It was white flight. They were leaving the cities because people of color were moving in droves and they didn't want to deal with it. Now we're actually dealing with the inverse. The suburbs are getting filled up because of wealth transfer, et cetera. The people of color are moving to the suburbs. Now whites are moving back to the cities, and we get this beautiful thing called gentrification. Beautiful, I say in humongous quotations, because it's destroying cultural and homes and such. And I find it interesting that we record this beyond the red line. This building is sitting beyond the red line. Mm-hmm. And we are having this discussion beyond in a place where not that many years ago, we wouldn't, Marcus and I would not be sitting at this table together because of those things. But things are changing. And so I think, long story short, Christian nationalism comes out of a bit of a belief of, I don't want things to change. I'm terrified of change. What does change mean?
Right.
Even though the American experiment has always been progress, change. Mm-hmm. We were set up to be a lot more open-ended to figure it out as destiny unfolded before us.
Right. Right. I know that this opens up a whole lot of conversations or questions for me that I won't go too heavily into, because I know you have a whole agenda here. But you mentioned Quakers, Chuck. I know by and large, not putting them all in a box, by and large, these people did not believe in slavery, if you will,
right.
You know, from my understanding. I'm curious as to where women fit into all of this as it's developing over time. I don't want to step on your timeline too much.
No, just talk. We're talking.
But where is that? Where do women fit into this evolutionary process?
They don't. I mean, okay. I personally, I think they do. I mean, the voice of women,
historically,
look at the place of women in the Bible. The smartest people, and I've said this a million times, the smartest people in the Bible are the women. The men never seem to get it, but the women always seem to get it. That's what I usually say in my sermons. But historically, there was no place. So when you think of the earliest foundation, how was governance done? White male landowner. So even poor white men didn't have a place. Women certainly didn't have a place. Mm-hmm. And you look at this history in my own family. My great grandmother was a teacher. Soon as she got married, the law said she had to stop teaching.
Really?
Yes. Because, and this was in Ohio, where I'm originally from, they said, you got to go home and take care of the family now. So she started out as a teacher, and then boom, you're out. Mm-hmm. And so where was the place of women there? Think about where women's rights. Women's rights and racial rights came along the same time and same place. But in this Christian nationalist movement, I don't hear a lot of female voices from anybody. It's a lot of white male voices. And so it does beg the question, where do they fit into this conversation? Because it seems to have been excluded quite a bit.
Mm. It's interesting. Mm-hmm. Some of the key voices that I hear out there, though, in government right now, are females.
Right.
Yes.
You got Lauren Boebert and
Marjorie Taylor Greene.
Both of whom proclaim their Christian nationalism proudly.
Right.
So what's wrong with Christian nationalism? I mean, don't we want to be more Christian as a nation? Why is that a bad thing?
I mean, I'd like a few more people in my chairs on Sunday, but that doesn't mean I want the government to run that. I think we get a very perverted version of both church and state if we do that.
I like that term.
It's perverted, and it gets twisted. If the state were to come in and start telling me or any denomination, this is how the sacraments will go. You will do them this way. You will marry these people, whether I agree with the position that somebody else takes or not. That is problematic. Because we have this beautiful separation that the church, and you can take this back to John Stuart Mill, who thought that the authority of the church, the authority of the state stopped at the church door. And the church's job was to produce moral good citizens who would participate in their society. But if the state is making those rules, or telling the church how to be the church, or telling people you must attend this church, you will be a part, then we're going right back to prior to the revolution, where whether you wanted to or not, you were a member of the Church of England. And in our own tradition, we mentioned my being Presbyterian, that was a splinter group. And you had to register with the state. Your ministers had to be registered. You collected no church taxes. You were not supported. It was an independent movement. And so it's no surprise that several, maybe not many, but several of the founding fathers were Presbyterians. And the form of government used in this country was that of the Presbyterian Church. Mm. Not because it was a Christian. They just liked that it was, well, decent and in order. It made good structure.
Yeah.
And they liked this. But it wasn't, they're not saying, oh, that church government's wonderful. Let's make our government like a church. It was just, hey, we like the way they do it. We don't know what to do. Let's do it this way. And so it allowed for a good foundation. But it was interesting when you read some of the earliest names or people who were so heavily in favor of the separation of church and state, most of them were ministers, mm-hmm. Baptist ministers, Presbyterian minister. John Witherspoon signs the Declaration of Independence. He was the president of a little-known place called Princeton. Mm-hmm. They wanted this because they wanted freedom away from a government-sponsored anything, mm-hmm. to be free to worship in their way and to think and pray and do as they would as they understood it. Mm-hmm. And they thought everybody else needs that chance too.
I think Pastor Himes is hitting on something for both the Chucks. And I don't say this to be funny. I think that you're getting at maybe some of the mindset behind this "Making America Great Again" mantra,
yeah.
Right? You mentioned good and decent order, and you know, not necessarily a matter of it being a religion, but that this is a good way of doing things. You think that these times that we're talking about, how much of this lends itself to people latching on to that catchphrase and saying yes? Yes, is it a feeling of there's just no order, this is chaos,
yeah.
You know, and it's how warranted is that? Because there's parts of this, listen, I'm a person who's all about structure and tradition. I've always called myself a Republican, right? Because I see both sides of some of these issues. How much of that ties into people latching on to this mindset?
I think that the whole MAGA movement folds in nicely to this because it wants us, by and large, to go back to a time when we would look at our communities and say, oh yeah, they're Christian.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure that was true, but we do sort of romanticize a particular era.
There's the 50s.
Yeah.
But Chuck, because you are involved in politics, first of all, I'm curious about how that happened. And second of all, I'm curious about how you bring your faith to bear in the public sphere, because you're living this in real time.
Yeah. I mean, and as we talk about separation of church and state, I'm a big fan of that. so like when I was running for office, I sent out mailers to what they call super voters, people that vote in every single election. And we had a woman with mental disabilities in the congregation that came in with it one day and was like, Pastor Chuck, you're running for city council. I'll vote. You know, like, and I was like, oh, like, because otherwise nobody, it wasn't discussed. Like, nobody was talking about me being in politics in church. And on the other side of it, like, city council has historically opened with prayer. Hmm. And I've actively rejected me being the guy that would do that and made it very clear that that was something that I didn't necessarily see as an appropriate thing for our body. So there, I've tried to put very clean lines on that, but obviously in a setting like this where I get to have just open conversation with some friends, the two come together a little more clearly. It's a matter of shared values in both cases. You know, like when we're talking about what it is that identifies a Christian, we're talking about in the context of like Matthew 25 and lifting up the least of these, recognizing the image of God on them. And when I'm in a political sphere, it's still, you know, lifting up the least of these, recognizing their humanity and their dignity in a democracy. And it, the terms change a little bit, but the values end up carrying from one to the other.
Yeah.
But I don't make any pretense about those values being merged. You know, it's just a matter of these are my personal values and
so
this
you're
is
bringing
how I carry them.
Your faith and the values that come along with your faith to decisions and to policies and to promotion of particular ideas, but you're not demanding that those things be imposed on everybody else. And I think there's a line there somewhere. We're not saying that Christians can't bring themselves in the wholeness of their beings to the political sphere. I think you have to. For me, what Jesus teaches, and this goes back to what you were saying, Drew, about which Christianity we're talking about. For me, Jesus is the Jesus of the Sermon on the Mount. And the values and the level of compassion and understanding that he speaks there. Hmm. That's who I follow. I follow that Jesus. Matthew 25, I follow that Jesus. That Jesus was advocating that we take care of the least of these, that we nurture people who are on the outside. Mm-hmm. He spent his time with those folks, with the prostitutes and the tax collectors and women, people who were not the privileged folks in those cultures, in that culture. So I think Jesus shows me a particular way of being in the world, mm-hmm. and that way of being that my faith has formed in me, I use to inform the decisions that I make in the world. I see the same kind of thing happening with you, Chuck. Am I saying?
Yeah, and I think one of the things that creates these different cultures is just the conflict that's within them. So, I mean, when we're going back and we're looking, and I'm pointing out these different conflict points that we've recently experienced, and we could even go back to the Reformation. And when we're looking at Luther, and now, you know, we'll talk about faith alone and Christ, you know, all that stuff. But what happened there is that they were very far away from Rome, and the papal bulls and indulgences were being taken and sent to Rome to build St. Peter's Basilica, and the widows were starving. Right. You know, and what ends up coming out of that is this picture that, and now when the widows stop starving, the dogma that is divorced from that original culture is that the focus becomes just on this orthodoxy, mm-hmm. instead of this orthopraxy.
Yeah.
And what we're now experiencing on this side of it is that a number of people that have faiths and beliefs that are formed out of crisis and out of conflict are no longer in a position of conflict. And the orthodoxy that's come out of that has now changed and changed the priorities. And now it is, and now they're standing in the shoes of the oppressor with that.
Yep.
And it becomes a real challenging position. And I think a lot of it, and when we look at people looking back to another time, they're still seeking a victimhood and an oppression on themselves, which comes out in a very strange narrative. It's just a weird narrative.
There's so much to talk about there.
So I do want to go back and just say, I appreciate the fact that you did not utilize your pulpit to campaign, if you will. I like the story about the person in your congregation coming up to you and you intentionally not making it a point of discussion. Because I was raised a religious, if you will, I struggle with, and I'm not knocking anyone who doesn't, I struggle with people bringing in political candidates and giving them 10, 15 minutes from the pulpit.
Yeah.
I struggle with the flag waving behind the pastor. I'm like, I just don't know if I feel like this is the place for that.
Absolutely.
So I appreciate your effort to say, let's see if we can draw some lines here. Because for a lot of people, it just feels like it's whatever. You know, these are my political views. I'm bringing it into the church. I dare you to say something about it. That should be a matter of discussion more at churches.
One of the points that is often used in the Christian nationalist discussion is Romans 13. Paul writes and says, obey the civil authority because it was ordained by God. And what makes me chuckle when we read that and go, yep, see, God ordained the civil authority, and so we must obey it. Paul never did. I'm pretty sure, as we understand, Paul got killed in Rome for not obeying the civil authority. And there was another guy. What was his name? Oh, Jesus, who also did not obey the civil authority. And I'm pretty sure we're in the season where we're preparing for the crucifixion and the resurrection because the charges were he violated the law of Rome. And so to say that Christianity is based in obedience to the civil authority would be a silly notion because two of the large voices, Jesus being the voice, and
the
Paul,
two main voices,
voices saying no. And that passage is always taken out of context. It's read just the first seven verses, obey the civil authority because ordained by God. But the next verse, love, everything is done out of love and you should owe no one anything because of love, etc. I think what Paul is getting at is looking at a civil authority that is just. And I think it's almost theoretical because it doesn't exist in his day. I don't think Paul is saying we should obey Caesar because Caesar is ordained by God. When I go into my own Reformation history, we look at John Calvin And John Calvin wasn't the greatest guy because he was trying to run Geneva like a theocracy, and it didn't work out well for him. But he talks about the civil authority. And he says, yeah, it was ordained by God, but it has its consent from the governed. And that there should be a separation between the church and the state. Mm-hmm. And that serving in the civil magistrate, as Chuck does beautifully, is a high calling.
Yeah.
But it's done because it's a servanthood of serving other people, not impressing upon them an agenda, which is what we see in Christian nationalism. There's an agenda, there's a script.
Yeah. I got so excited when you were talking about the context of Romans 13, and I thought you were going to go before it instead of after it.
What's before it, Chuck?
Before, yeah, give us the before it.
Before it is that the reason you obey them is that when they are wicked, it is coals on their head in judgment.
Yes.
So, I mean, the context right. there, I don't know. You went the love direction. I was looking at the, hey, man.
I like love.
yes, sir, may I have another? Because you know God is just.
Right.
So I was going the other way on that context.
Yeah. If you've seen the Color Purple, this is the part where they start singing, God is trying to tell you something. Because I've heard that scripture used in that context. Absolutely. And I've often thought to myself, like, are we analyzing the whole thing? Like, you're throwing that out there like you have this magic blanket you can just cover over this discussion and that solves it. That's not where I think we're going with that.
But that's a huge part of Christian nationalism.
Yeah.
Is that scripture is read in isolation.
Yes.
It is not read historically. We can't say that just because the text of Scripture tells us more than 100 times that slavery is okay, that slavery is okay. We have learned, we have progressed as a people, as a society. We can look at that and say that was for their day. And you can't read anything in isolation. It has to be read historically. We have to understand who was this, where did it come from, what was their life like. If I divorce Romans 13 from the story of Paul and who he is, and best as we can reconstruct historically, we know this guy wasn't following the rules. But if I read it simply in isolation and take the words in my English Bible and lift them completely out of their original context, I can make them say anything I want. Mm-hmm. Frankly, I could do that with a phone book, but we're talking about the Bible at this point. And so we have to think, what's really going on here? Because you're right. It's read and it's used. Oh, obey the civil magistrate.
Yeah. You okay. can pick out pieces and make a case for almost anything.
Absolutely.
From any book the size of the scriptures. And we always end up back in this place when we're talking right. about these things in a Christian context is how do we read scripture? Mm. And I think for me, the lens upon which or through which I view scripture these days has become what you were talking about, yeah. Drew, has become that I see in the New Testament a real push towards emphasizing love. And I'm reading the New Testament. I'm reading all of scripture through that particular lens. And I think that I see that in your work, Chuck. So I've been able to read a part of Chuck's PhD thesis he's working on, right? PhD thesis.
Doctor of ministry, yeah, same thing.
Okay,
yeah.
And it's a doctoral thing. Yeah. And,
it's a doctoral thing. <you're,
laughs> He's a smart guy, ladies and
gentlemen. Absolutely, yeah.
He's a smart guy.
Absolutely.
He's written about the biblical impetus to take care of the poor.
Yeah.
Which was part of what pushed him to come and do the work that he does here in the city in his church. And he makes the distinction between orthodoxy and orthopraxy and continues to pound that through that chapter that I read. And for me, it just kept saying to me, you will know a tree by its fruits. Jesus says to his disciples in a number of places, you will know a tree by its fruits, not by its belief system, not by its rituals, not by its orthodoxy, but by its fruits, by its actions. And that's the only place I can go anymore. I can't talk to you about your doctrine of the Trinity. I can't talk to you about what do you believe about Jesus in terms of the dual nature of Jesus. I can only talk to you about, are we embodying, incarnating love? I see that happening in Chuck's ministry. I know Church of the Cross. I see that happening there. Marcus, I'm not so sure about, but isn't that for me? That's Absolutely. The fundamental thing, and so I'm going to read the scriptures, not picking out a piece here and a piece there to justify what I want to believe, but I'm going to read the scriptures to speak to me about how best to live this life in a loving way, which is what I think Jesus calls us to do, and which is what he's talking about when he talks about the kingdom of God, which is a fundamental emphasis in his teaching in the Gospels.
Yeah, whatever your clique is, I don't care if it's religious or political or what have you, if by and large this clique is very judgmental, if by and large this clique has very little empathy, if the fruit that you bear looks like that in too many areas, I mean, I would think as a human being, you'd start just reanalyze it. Well, what am I a part of? Because it just feels like with every other group, we've got something negative to say, feel, or do.
We need enemies.
Towards, exactly.
Well, you and I, we interviewed Kristen Cobes-Demey
that was a
year and a half ago.
Book. That was good.
And one of the things that she says in her book, Jesus and John Wayne, is that a certain strand of evangelicalism, and it becomes bigger and bigger, requires enemies in order to exist.
Yeah.
Man, I hate that. We're supposed to be doing exactly the opposite of that, not finding enemies, but loving people into something new and better and beautiful. And Ed Stetzer, Chuck and I, Nelson and I were talking about Ed Stetzer a while back, and Ed was the founding pastor of the Mill Creek Community Church. Mm-hmm. He's a big deal in Southern Baptist, in the Southern Baptist Conference. He said not too long ago, he said, we are not particularly known. And he's talking about evangelicals in general. We are not particularly known as for being loving. and we got to change that. And the opinion of the world about us is that we're just a bunch of angry white people trying to impose our ideas and our ways on the rest of the world. And that's what Christian nationalism speaks to me. Not everybody who believes in Christian nationalism wants to do that. But I think that's the undertext for a lot of the leadership in the Christian nationalist movement. We are going to impose. And when we impose, we're going to exclude LGBTQ people from positions of power. We're not going to marry them. We're not going to let new people into this country. We're going to close the borders. We're going to put women back in the kitchen, and we're going to shut down the possibility of abortion. And there's a whole series of things that we're going to do that are going to truncate the lives of people in this country who don't particularly believe in the same thing that we believe in. But we're right, and so we're going to impose that. I think one of the things you have to do with your faith when you read scripture, when you promote your faith, is you have to do it with humility, knowing that you don't know everything.
Let me throw a little psychotherapy thought in here, because one of the 42,000 things I do in my life, one of these days I'm going to grow up and decide to do one thing, but I really enjoy doing them all. There's a sense, as I've looked at this, not just from a theological perspective or a political perspective, but from a kind of a psychological perspective, is what you were saying, Chuck, without saying the word, was control. Mm. There is a fear, and when we act out of fear, we act to try to control. It's a natural human response.
Excellent point.
Call it a traumatic response, if you will.
Why are we so afraid? And what are we afraid of?
Oh, I'm not afraid. I mean, there's some things I'm afraid of.
Isn't that sort of a cultural thing right now, that there's a lot of fear out there?
It's that progress is happening too fast. Things are going too quickly. We need to slow it down just a little bit.
I was trying to introduce a new show. Go ahead.
We got plenty of time to explore that later on.
That is so true.
And there is a certain part of it where I sometimes feel like a Luddite or like a cranky old man, where I hear about AI and I'm like, uh-oh, I don't like this. This is way too techno-friendly. But there's a little bit of progress, you know, and some of it I'm like, I don't know, because I don't understand it. But sometimes that's what it is. It's something we don't understand.
Yeah.
And so it's operating out of fear, and fear is control. And we try to gain back the control we don't feel we have inside of ourselves, in our psyches, by exercising them in a physical way. Mm. And so we impress upon people certain beliefs, values, etc. If a church argues that LGBT people should not be allowed to be married in their church, I'll be the first one to defend it, whether I agree with you or not, because that is the freedom of religion.
Right.
If you don't believe that abortion is moral, again, as part of your church belief, I'll be the first one to defend you, whether I agree with you or not, because, again, this is how freedom of religion works. But when we try to make moral codes, the Romans tried doing this, and it didn't work for them. If we try to make moral codes, we're going to start cutting a whole lot of people out. Mm-hmm. And we can say within this communion, within this faith tradition, we don't believe in XYZ. Good for you. I totally support your ability to do that. You feel free to do it. But when you try to impress it upon the general public and say, this is the way things must be, you are trying to set up a theocracy in Christian nationalism ways. Mm-hmm. Let's look at some of the theocratic governments. Nowhere anybody wants to live. Iran, Afghanistan, North Korea. Nobody wants to live there.
No.
because there's no freedom. Yeah. No freedom of anything.
Even Calvin's Geneva.
Oh, God, Calvin's Geneva was a terrible place.
We were burning people at the stake because they disagreed with us on particular orthodox.
Or we were drowning them because they were Anabaptists, and that didn't, that wasn't good.
Oh, so that was our way of handling the baptism issue.
Yeah, exactly. I'm not saying it was a great place, and I'm not saying Calvin was a great.
We're going to baptize you.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I know that we're diving into this, but Chuck Nelson, from a layman's perspective, this, what we're describing as Christian nationalism and what some of us know it to be on the surface, it feels like it is at the root of a lot of decision making on the political landscape right now between the political parties, one party in particular, the Supreme Court. I mean, what are you seeing? How much is it ingrained into what's playing out in front of us, in your opinion? And what's kind of your forecast to how this is going to continue to influence the political landscape in this country?
One of the things I read an article on Pew Research, and they were defining like the beliefs of various types of churches. So like the black church versus like evangelical church. And when it came to issues of like the virgin birth or the doctrines of scripture or the deity of Christ, like there was a ton of agreement. And then you got into these like particular social issues and the ones that are more associated with a political party. And you watch like a quick 180 degree divide on that. This is pretty, I think, a telling thing as to like the defining points of Christian nationalism, these political points that they've embedded into their faith as well. And I think that as long as the communities are in a homogenous type of setting, that you're going to continue to see this continue to grow. But as someone was, as Drew was talking about earlier, with like this shift of, and I think it's a regression to means, but you know, in the generations of white flight and now this gentrification, I think we're seeing a regression to means where there is a more heterogeneous community developing. And when that happens, I think the values that are reflected do challenge this Christian nationalist movement. Absolutely. In a way that it can't resist. I think the tidal wave that is building, this is a last ditch effort to hold back a change that is going to be a tidal wave. And it's just a matter of, even when I was talking about the Bibles that they're given in the 40s, and then that means that a generation, the boomers, were taught this in Sunday school. Well, the people that adopted those views, they had kids my age that have looked back and said, oh, I kind of like this theology from the 19th century a little bit better. Mm-hmm. And they haven't adopted it at the same rate. I think this all changes really quickly in 20 years, and that this and that every single election will be able to measure how quickly this is dying. Mm-hmm. It's just becoming more violent in its death. Mm-hmm. Like a dog. You ever deal with a dog that's about to die? I mean, it doesn't matter if it's your man's best friend. It'll bite you.
Yeah.
It's in pain. Yeah. And that's where this Christian nationalist culture is. It is a culture that is in pain and dying. And they're biting now. They're biting a lot.
Yeah. It's fascinating to watch from the sidelines and to just kind of see how everything is developing. Your assessment, is very intriguing, Chuck. Very intriguing. Because my favorite question is, okay, where are we going with this? And devoid of a lot of background, as I'm watching it grow, I'm fascinated by how many people are latching on to some of this old school thought process. And it's to the point where you can't just, oh, they're tripping. There's too many people who are signing on to this for us to dismiss it that simply. So yeah, some of us are just kind of grabbing our popcorn and nervously saying, we gotta see where this is going, especially as you see the Supreme Court being heavily influenced by this mindset and making decisions along those lines.
But you notice that it's not, Chuck, you pointed out beautifully, there's a divorce between those who are governing and the governed, the people and the government. And we're noticing that a lot of the work being done in the Christian nationalist movement is what I would call maneuvering. It's not being done by popular election. It's not being done by the ballot box. Because if that were so, then you'd say there's a tidal wave of people who are very much supporting this ideology. Mm-hmm. But when you look in the last several election cycles, you look at some fundamentally red states, and they're upholding the right to abortion at the ballot box. You're looking at other states where they've been more purple or slightly leaning red, and they're doing the same thing. That when given the choice over to the people, They're deciding based on their thoughts, their beliefs, mm-hmm. what they want. And so the governments of those places that are heavily influenced by this Christian nationalist thinking are maneuvering by packing courts,
yes.
by passing laws yes. done in the dark of night, doing all sorts of things that are trying to pry back that authority. They're acting as though they're a completely separate body and that they are not a council or, you know, Congress or whatever of the governed, who act on behalf of the people who elected them. Mm-hmm. And when you give people that option, and we saw this happen in, I believe it was Kansas, with mm-hmm. the abortion question. Mm-hmm. We saw mm-hmm. this happen in Ohio mm-hmm. Last year when they also legalized marijuana, which everybody was really shocked by. And it almost immediately afterwards, the state house and the state senate, which are overwhelmingly controlled by one party, started writing laws to eradicate the people's vote yeah. and to strip it back because they didn't like this and yeah. they didn't know what to do when the people actually speak. And so Chuck's description that there's a tidal wave behind it and that what we're seeing in Christian nationalism or the MAGA movement is a death gasp. This is the last grab for power, trying to grab for power to insulate away these progressive changes of you there, do as you will.
There's a couple of sociologists, I can't remember their names, who have written a book after compiling a huge database based on studying Christian nationalism and kind of what kind of attitudes do people have and where they fall on this spectrum and what attitudes go with which ends of the spectrum. But they say this about Christian nationalism, that fundamentally it's about three things. It is about power, it is about boundaries, and it's about order. All of those things play into what you're talking about, Drew, about fear. When people are afraid, they want power so they can control things. Mm-hmm. When people are afraid, they want boundaries, to create boundaries to keep you out so that I can stay safe on the inside. And they want order above all things. So what we're seeing is people who are afraid. And part of me wants to understand those people, wants to hear their stories, yeah. wants to sympathize with them. And I think that's one of the things that I find missing in some of these discussions from folks who may be more liberal or progressive, is now we're developing a level of judgment and hatred against folks
sure.
that I think is no different from what we're getting. And just as a recipe for civil conflict. Yeah. It doesn't have to be that way, but somebody has to show the way. And I think that, for me, that's incumbent upon us in the church. I don't know if you know the work of Brian Zond. I love Brian Zond. He's a pastor who, he had a 1,500 member church. He's a big evangelical role model. He was one of those people that folks pointed to and said, this is how you do it. And then he started to have misgivings about his evangelicalism. And he started to talk about maybe we need to be more open to people who aren't like us. And and he moved away from the sort of strict model of evangelicalism, preached his church down to 200 people from 1,500. And he's happy as a clam because he said, I'm just being me. And one of the things he says is, I love this quote. He says, in the church today, in too many places, we are forming our people in anger. And then he makes this statement. We are not called to change the world in the church. We are called to be the world already changed and thereby to influence the world around us. That's what it means to be salt and light in his mind. That is a profound and provocative quote. The Christian nationalist wants to change the world through legislation and other kinds of things. And by the way, Christian nationalists are a minority in this country, as are right-wing MAGA Republicans. Mm-hmm. The majority of Americans don't think that way. And we, in fact, have minority rule in this country now. Yeah. A smaller group of people than the rest of us are running us. In every election in every one of the last 20 elections, national elections, the every two-year elections, Senate, Congress, President, every one of those elections in the last 20 elections, Americans have voted in a majority of Americans have voted, I'm going to say this right eventually, a majority of Americans have voted Democratic. But in every one of those elections, Republicans have gained seats. Why is that? Because we have a system that, and we're talk about gerrymandering down the line here, we have a system that's gerrymandered, and we have an electoral college that gives rights to the minority. Great. But now the minority is ruling the rest of us, and we don't have their values. Americans, by and large, are in favor of reasonable gun legislation. Americans, by and large, are in favor of allowing people to make their own choices when it comes to abortion. And you just go right down the issues. They want more government involvement in protecting the environment. And that's the majority of us, but our voice is not being heard. And movements like the Christian nationalist movement are trying to make that, concretize that so that we don't get a chance to have a say. Mm-hmm. So it looks to me like the majority of Americans are basically pretty solid, compassionate, understanding people, but we're not getting those voices. Those voices aren't being allowed to rule us.
Chuck, you're the host today, and you're the one asking questions, but I want to ask a question.
Ask one.
I want to ask Chuck a question. The discussion we've had thus far has been about this movement on the national stage that we all see. In your position in local government, and as we all remember, all government's local, you know, right. that's the biggest effect on our lives. Mm-hmm. How much do you see this coming from the constituency that you represent or that comes before the council on a regular basis? Or is this more of a national conversation more than local?
On the political side, you know, I represent a city. So, I mean, so it's blue. You know, I mean, our elections are determined in a Democratic primary. So my conversations are politically end up being pretty pretty far to one side.
Sure.
And then my licensure, my ordination stuff, that comes from the Conservative Congregational Christian Conference. I mean, we are 1,000 members of clergy. I can I know the one associate pastor down in Georgia is black.
One
out of 1,000.
I mean, I remember there was one up in Maine, but he died. Like, I mean, it's very, and so you can imagine the political leanings of that. So, I mean, I'm in conversations that are almost homogenous on either side and maybe complete opposite, pretty consistently. Mm. And I find that I can speak the terms, you know, I understand the terms, and, it's just a matter of, you know, to how violently angry people get in a discussion. Mm. But the stuff that we're up against in the political sphere of it in the city, you know, I've been careful to find the terms that get people on board with things. You know, we have an issue on the agenda tonight that I changed a couple words on it. And all of a sudden, the two sides divided over it can come together and say, "Yeah, we all agree on that." Hmm. It's particular that to have people that can walk, you know, both lanes of traffic between that divide.
Hmm. Yeah, that's really good.
Finding common ground.
By the way, I'm ceding my hostship to Drew because he asked really good questions.
That was a good question.
It was just one question. Don't look at me.
It was one question. I want to remind you, it's the next with Marcus Atkinson, Drew. Next with Marcus Atkinson, not next with Drew Hines.
That's right.
He points that out a lot.
Hey, it came to my brain and I wanted to know.
That was an excellent question. Chuck, listen, the political currency for people who can walk that
absolutely
line and bring both aisles together is, in my mind, an all-time high, because I don't care what news channel you're watching. Everybody has their heels dug in so deeply on right one side or the other. And I think the positive of being raised in an environment that didn't get involved with politics, that didn't get involved with religion, was to see the negative and the positive of all of it. And I just don't believe you can have 20 siblings of two very loving parents. Those 20 siblings do not see their parents the same. They don't have the same experience. They're not going to agree on everything. I get nervous when I see a large group of people in lockstep ideologically. I'm thinking, you don't see any of the negatives of your side,
right,
or any of the positives of this? That's not realistic. So keep doing that, because to me, we just don't have enough of that
absolutely
in politics.
It's a gift, Chuck, to be able to speak both languages
We're convinced
and interpret one another to each other.
We're convinced nationally that kind of what you were leading to earlier, Chuck, was that, you know, 50% of the country is either very liberal or very conservative, and everybody else is a lot smaller. Or realistically, that you hear it more like 90% is liberal or conservative, it's divided somewhere, and then everybody else kind of filters. And we know it's actually the inverse,
yeah.
That maybe 10% are very liberal, maybe 10% are very conservative. Everybody else kind of
in the middle.
Yeah, everybody filters in the middle. And I actually just read a book, and I cannot remember the author's name. I feel terrible, but it was about the history of the Electoral College and where that's at and such. The title of the book was "Let the People Vote." Mm. So I got to remember the author. Anyway. He brought it out and he said, if you look at any election map and you drill down and don't look at the state map, just zoom in a little bit and you'll see how purple America really is. When you get to counties, towns, et cetera,
yeah.
That there's a lot more common ground. There's a lot more shared ideology, a lot more shared in the idea that kind of on our money, out of many, one. There's a lot of different views, but let's figure out how we do that together.
So I think this begs another conversation on this topic. In which we will talk about how do we respond to Christian nationalists, which really is a topic about how we talk to one another about the big issues in our world, and we're really bad at it right now in America, maybe globally, but particularly in America. There's a guy who is a wonderful pastor out of Minnesota. Who has developed an organization called Vote Common Good. Doug Padgett is his name. And he's agreed to come on the program down the line. And he's developed a curriculum, the last part of which is how do we talk to one another about these things? And he comes across with such gentleness and such compassion that I'm really drawn to his way of doing things. I tend to be much more Sicilian and passionate. He's thoughtful. You remind me of him, Chuck. Well-spoken, measured, patient, respectful. And we need more of that. That is where we're going to go with this somewhere not too far down the line.
And when we do it, I suggest that we bring these two gentlemen back.
I would love
another person or two. This has been a wonderful perspective on all of this. I think it's been extremely educational for me just from being at the table. I would hope and I would assume that the listener is getting just as much, if not more,
I hope
from this. We got to do this again.
Absolutely. And I think this is where, in the dialogue, we help to clarify for one another what's going on out there, because we all represent different parts of out there.
Mm-hmm.
We want to have a more diverse group. We're going to get a big table, just have a Downeybrook about issues like this.
Well, we recorded in the auxiliary room at the King Center before we
there. Yeah, absolutely.
Chuck's very familiar. You taught wrestling there for a long time.
Yeah.
You know, so we can go back and do that. But listen, thank you all so much. Pastor Drew Himes, Pastor Chuck Nelson, Pastor Chuck Camerata, and not so pastory Marcus Atkinson. And that's it for our show today. Tune in next time for more discussion and analysis with local and national guests. I want you to remember that Next 2.0 streams on Fridays on all major podcast platforms and the fourth Sunday of the month at 4 p.m. on WQLN NPR, which is 91.3 FM. We've got a new feature for you today. If you want to leave a message, you got a comment or a suggestion for the show, you can now call the Next hotline and leave a message. You can even text to 814-240-8816. We look forward to hearing from you. Get your thoughts together and let us know how you feel. I'm Marcus Atkinson. Come and join us again so that you can hear about what's next for our communities and our democracy. Peace.